Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Metastatic Lung Cancer. This is a very important program, and it's a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 569 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and different parts of the country. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Italy, and the United Kingdom, and Jordan. So you really come from all over the world. This program today was made possible by an educational grant from Genentech Bio-Oncology. And we really want to thank them for their support of this program today. And I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers have prepared. There also is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource to you, and there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you each to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can really best tell us the programs you'd like us to offer? Indeed, today's topic was one that many of you have asked us to offer. We've offered many programs on lung cancer, but you've asked for us to offer a program on metastatic lung cancer, and we listened to you, and we're offering the program today. So tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is Chief Thoracic Oncology Service. He's the William and Joy Royne Chair in Thoracic Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He's also a professor of medicine at Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Criss is going to present an overview of metastatic lung cancer, the current standard of care, and the role of targeted treatments in chemotherapy. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Criss.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. And again, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about this field and about a field that is a very dynamic and one where I think we have greater hope than we've had in decades that we can really influence the lives of people with this illness. I think the first concept is that lung cancer is not one illness. We know that the course of the disease is very different from person to person. And one thing we have learned in the last few years is that the term lung cancer does not really reflect what we see in the persons that we care for. It truly is a disease, many diseases, and I think the term really should be not lung cancer, but lung cancers. I think that also reflects our interest and focus on personalized medicine, where we try to choose the best treatments for that person to moderate and change our plans of care based on how a person reacts to that treatment, and calling it lung cancer is one step away from where we really are, and I think that's one fundamental change that we have seen, and we're going to continue to see that change affect the whole field over the next years to come. Just to be clear, too, many cancers can spread to the lung. So, for example, you may have cancer in the colon or the breast, originates there, and at some point in the illness spreads to the lung. That is not what we are talking about today. We are talking about cancers that originate in the lung, that come from lung tissue. And in general, all cancers are treated by not necessarily their location, but their site of origin. Now, lung cancer can actually be metastatic to the lung, can affect a different part of the lung, can affect the opposite lung. But what we are talking about today is cancer that originated in the lung. Cancer nowadays is further defined by the examination of the tissue under the microscope. And I think there's a common misconception I would like to dispel right away, that lung cancers or any cancer can be diagnosed from a scan or a blood test. That's absolutely not the case. The only way that cancer can be accurately and definitively diagnosed is with a biopsy. So in 2012, no matter what it shows on a scan, it is perhaps suspicious for cancer or compatible with a cancer, but it's not cancer until a biopsy has been done. So the biopsy is absolutely essential. And what that biopsy tells us in the case of lung cancers is which cell type of cancer it is. And there are various ones, small cell, non-small cell. And within that category of non-small cell, there are three major types. The adenocarcinoma, which is the most common one, probably about three-quarters of the cases. Squamous carcinoma, about 20% or the remaining quarter, and then very rarely something called large cell carcinoma. So that determination by a pathologist from the biopsy material is absolutely critical in saying what the course of the illness is and deciding treatment. I'll get back to that in a second. The other issue that has changed in recent years is the growing understanding that the genetic that the each type of lung cancer is genetically determined. And we now have tests available that can be done to help determine which genetic type of lung cancer we are dealing with. And that tells us even more precisely what the course will be and what kind of treatment will be recommended. So it's very common now that at diagnosis, a genetic test is done on the tumor tissue. And I'll get back to that as well. The last point at the beginning of a time where cancer is diagnosed is this term staging. Staging is after the diagnosis of cancer, after the definitive decision that we are dealing with lung cancer, the next step is to define exactly where the cancer is in the body. Sometimes the size and the location if there's been any spread. A lot of tests are done for that. CT scans, computed tomography scans, MRI scans, magnetic resonance imaging scans, and also PET scans. All those things are done not necessarily to diagnose the cancer, but to tell you where in the body the cancer is precisely located. And it is that decision of the pathologist that we're dealing with cancer and dealing with lung cancer and of your physician reviewing all those tests that helps determine the best treatment. There's one additional aspect of care that I want to remind everybody of is that at every step of the illness, it is extremely important to address the symptoms that cancer has caused, so-called symptom management, supportive care, supportive oncology. Sometimes the term palliative oncology is used. But at every point, no matter what stage you are, no matter what type you are, it is very important that we deal with the symptoms of the illness. There are things that can be done while these tests are underway to help you. For example, if you're troubled by cough, you know, getting the right medication, like a codeine medication for cough, to make your life better while this diagnosis is going on, while you're waiting for your operation, that's something very helpful and that needs to be addressed at the time the cancer is diagnosed. What are the current standards of care for lung cancers? Well, if the cancer is confined to the lung itself, the standard is and will remain for the indefinite future in operation, a surgery. There are some special situations where surgery can't be done, and that's something that your surgeon would direct you to if a surgery cannot be done. The second kind of cancer at discovery is if the cancer is in the chest but has spread beyond the lung. I mean, most commonly, it's found in lymph glands and the lung and nowhere else. Those cancers are best dealt with chemotherapy combined either with radiation or surgery. That's not the topic for today, but just to let you know that cancer that's localized to the chest is treated with surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, and your doctors will determine which is best for you. When cancer has spread from the lung to any other site other than the immediately adjacent lymph glands, the treatment there is a drug therapy, and the type of drug, again, is chosen by your oncologist. But for cancer that is spread, the treatment are drugs. How is that treatment decided? First and foremost, your oncologist will look at the specific cell type of treatment. So first, with squamous cell cancer, again, affecting about a quarter of the patients. The treatment there for chemotherapy would be the drug cisplatin with either a gemcitabine or a taxane drug like paclitaxel or docetaxel. For small cell lung cancer that is metastatic, the treatment there would be cisplatin or carboplatin with etoposide. Adenocarcinoma is the next group of diseases that require chemotherapy, and there the standard of care is a drug now called pemetrexed, given with cisplatin or carboplatin. An additional drug that's commonly used in those patients is a drug called bevacizumab. This agent is effective by improving the rates of tumor shrinkage, the time free of cancer, and survival in addition to receiving chemotherapy. There's some special exclusions there if you've had a stroke or a heart attack, if you have a coughing of blood at any point in your illness, if you have diverticulitis, then we would not be recommending bevacizumab for patients with adenocarcinoma. It's also not helpful in small cell. It's not helpful in squamous cancer and would not be given for those. But again, it's a very useful drug. I mentioned before the enhanced ability we have to analyze tumor tissues to help decide whether or not a targeted therapy is helpful. And it is now a standard of care that at the time of diagnosis, a biopsy is done and sent to the pathology department looking for specific mutations. And if these mutations are found, it directs you to a specific care. Two examples of that are the EGFR mutation that would direct your doctor to recommend a drug called erlotinib. The second one would be a rearrangement in the ALK gene, so-called ALK-positive lung cancer. And patients whose tumors have those characteristics would be recommended to receive a drug, crizotinib. Even if you don't have those tumors, it's still good information because rather than give you erlotinib or crizotinib, which have a very tiny chance of helping you, your doctor can go on and recommend a better treatment. So, again, these mutations are changes in the cancer cells, not changes in you. These are not things that you can pass on or have passed on to your children. The tests are done in the pathology department from the tumor tissue. And the tests actually are available throughout the United States, and individual pathology departments do them. They also have the capability to send it to other places. The test takes only a few days within the pathology department, but the way pathology departments are organized today, it generally takes somewhere from 1 to 2 weeks to get these results. And I know that's a very discouraging thing for a person's ready to start treatment, that your doctor may say to you it takes 1 to 2 weeks to get this test result to help determine your care. So I ask you to be respectful of that and to try to come to live with that. And if your doctor feels that you cannot wait for the results, chemotherapy is a good choice for everybody, whether or not a mutation is found in their tumor or not. And so where doctors can't wait, they can recommend a chemotherapy for you. Dr. Wakely will be talking about new treatments as well. I just want to say about two things that came up at the ASCO meeting, and just words that every patient should hear. There were, one of them was the identification of a drug called olanzapine, which is a useful drug for helping with nausea and vomiting brought on by cancer treatments. And the nice thing about this program, reported by Dr. Navari from the University of Indiana, is that this medicine helps on top of all the other medicines, the ondansetron, the aprepitant, the dexamethasone. This helps those patients that haven't been helped by the standard medicines. It's called olanzapine. It's available to your doctors today, and I think that's a useful piece of information that came out of the ASCO meeting this year. Another piece of information that came out of the ASCO meeting last year and was just published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology is that the drug naproxen, a very related to the drug you can get in the drugstore, naproxen, is very effective in treating the aches and pains that follow the growth factors like filgrastim or pegfilgrastim. I know many of you patients may have received those drugs, know the achiness that in the back and in the lower reaches that you can have. This drug, naproxen, was found to be safe and found to relieve that problem. So to summarize, you need a biopsy. The pathologist tells your doctor exactly what kind of cancer. The pathologist may give molecular information, and by using that information, your doctor can choose the best therapy to fight your cancer. It's absolutely critical information. Take some time to get, but make sure that you get a good information from your doctor about what tests are being done, how long it's going to wait, and I assure you that the time waiting for those test results to come in is well worth it as long as your doctor feels it's safe for you.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Chris. An outstanding presentation, lots of information for everybody, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Maria Werner-Wasik. Dr. Werner-Wasik is Professor, Residency Program Director, Department of Radiation Oncology, Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. And Dr. Werner-Wasik is going to address the role of radiation oncology, the overview of radiation treatments, and communicating with the healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Werner-Wasik.
Thank you very much. I'll be more than happy to talk about radiation therapy, which is a local treatment used very commonly in patients with metastatic lung cancer, whether it's small cell or non-small cell. What is radiation therapy? It's a treatment using essentially high-energy X-rays, which penetrate through the body and get into the tumor. So the same, similar X-rays is used for a chest X-ray, but much stronger, more penetrating, therefore more effective. And this treatment is non-invasive. It doesn't cause any pain. You don't feel it. You don't see it. And most of the time it's given daily in small doses or fractions, although sometimes can be given as one big fraction. So the patient usually will lay on the table in a comfortable position, and the X-rays will be directed in the area of interest. And the radiation therapy is very effective in controlling either completely or improving symptoms caused by lung cancer. It may also prevent symptoms from happening, and I will give you some examples. So as already stated by Dr. Mark Chris, metastatic lung cancer can occur in several areas of the body, notably in the bone, sometimes in the brain, in the adrenal glands, and so forth. And also it originates in the chest, where not rarely we are faced with a large lung mass which needs to be addressed because it either causes problems or may cause them in the future. So radiation therapy is extremely effective for several of such symptoms. Let's start with something medical doctors call hemoptysis, which is coughing up blood or seeing maybe streaks of blood in the phlegm. And for that condition, a course of radiotherapy directed at the lung mass is found to be able to control this coughing up blood in over 80% of cases within a week or two from starting treatment. So that's usually very gratifying, and patients feel so much better about not seeing blood in their phlegm. Breathing may be also impaired by a lung mass. For example, because the tumor may be pressing on the airway, or it may be pressing on the airway and the blood vessels and causing shortness of breath. And again, if we direct a potent radiation treatment at the tumor in the lung pressing on the airway, in many cases we are able to reopen the airway or increase the opening or the airway, sometimes alone with radiation or in combination with other surgical procedures such as placing the stent or using a laser opening of the airway. So that again makes the patient feel better and breathe easier, and it's makes for a good feeling and improved quality of life. Sometimes patients will have pain in the chest wall because the tumor may extend into the chest wall, and again radiation therapy is good for that. We also sometimes treat lung masses before they give symptoms. For example, when we see a mass localized in a specific spot in the right chest next to the large vein which drains blood from the upper part of the body, it's called superior vena cava or SVC. So if we see the tumor sort of being close there, we may give radiation therapy even though the vein is not quite compressed. We just know from experience if you let it grow, it may compress the vein, it may cause unpleasant symptoms such as swelling of the face, trouble breathing, sort of swooshing sound in the head, and so forth. So we call it SVC syndrome, and we want to prevent it with a short course of radiation. How long is the course of radiation for metastatic lung cancer? There may be several different courses, and I want patients to understand that and their families, that there's no always one best approach, and then it's tailored to the patient's needs. The classic length of radiation treatment may be 2 weeks, which will be 10 treatments given daily over the weekdays with a break for the weekend. But the same treatment may be sometimes delivered over 5 treatments, meaning 1 week, and sometimes even 1 treatment, for example, for bone metastasis. And effectiveness is very similar between those different schedules. So also in the lung, outside of the primary tumor mass, sometimes we can be faced with a new tumor which had spread to the lung, small tumor, and that can be addressed with a novel radiation treatment, which we call stereotactic body radiation therapy, which may be either delivered with a machine you probably heard about called CyberKnife, or with a standard linear accelerator suited for stereotactic treatments. And that treatment is very simple in that for the patient, in that it requires just 3 sessions of radiation therapy with a large focused doses of radiation. Not all tumors are suitable, only those which are the smallest and located at the periphery of the lung. So I just want you to know that CyberKnife and stereotactic body radiotherapy are interchangeable terms, and you don't need a CyberKnife to get an equivalent treatment, although obviously CyberKnife is a great machine. So moving on to the bone, radiation therapy is very effective for relieving bone pain, and I just want to make sure that people understand that before the doses of narcotic medications are increased in order to control pain, it may be worthwhile to ask that question, whether radiation therapy should be given first to see how much pain relief is obtained before the patient is just asked to go up on their pain medications. And radiation therapy relieves pain in approximately 70 or 80% of cases, not completely, but at least improves it. And what's the benefit of it? The patient feels better, and the doses of narcotic medications can be decreased, with all potential side effects also being increased, such as constipation, nausea, and somnolence or sleepiness and fatigue. Recently, we've had progress in the technique of radiotherapy for bone metastasis, particularly in the spine, near the spinal cord, and that's called IMRS, or intensity modulated radiosurgery, where only large dose of radiation is directed with the complex, technically advanced stereotactic treatment at the tumor near the spinal cord in the bone, and that's also extremely effective. Again, not all tumors qualify. They have to be at certain distance from the spinal cord, certain location, and so forth, but that's worth explaining, and we have a clinical trial which is trying to compare this advanced IMRS versus standard radiation. Now I would encourage anybody who has access to get enrolled. Brain is another frontier for radiation therapy in lung cancer, and the standard treatment is whole brain radiotherapy. Even if we see 1 or 2 spots from the tumor in the brain, and patients are frequently perplexed, how come we treat the whole brain? And the theory is that those small tumors have spread from elsewhere in the body to the brain with the blood. Therefore, chances are there are some microscopic or small, tiny cells elsewhere in the brain which are sitting there, and if we don't treat the whole brain, they may sprout and cause new tumors. There's some controversy whether whole brain is better or versus local treatment such as gamma knife radiosurgery, when we only focus on the specific tumors without treating whole brain, and whether whole brain can be given later should there be need with new tumors arriving. I feel rather strongly, and I'm from the school of whole brain radiotherapy for lung cancer being used up front, being of more benefit. For other tumors, there may be not quite the case, such as melanoma or renal cell carcinoma. In addition, patients who have a single one brain metastatic focus, if it can be removed surgically and the patient is in good enough condition that it can be removed surgically, should seek a neurosurgical opinion, because patients who have a single brain metastatic focus, if they get surgery followed by whole brain radiation, have actually longer survival than those who get whole brain radiotherapy alone, so it's important to at least ask that question about surgery. Alternatively, those patients who have a single brain lesion and who are scheduled to have whole brain radiotherapy, and the tumor is such a location that it cannot be removed, or the patient is not a candidate for surgery, those patients should be considered for first whole brain radiotherapy for 2 or 3 weeks of daily treatments, followed by radiosurgery with the gamma knife or stereotactic linear accelerator just to the spot in the brain where the lesion is located. And then again, this is known to prolong survival. So that would conclude my comments on palliative or radiotherapy in metastatic lung cancer, and I would be happy to take questions later in the Q&A portion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Warner-Lasek, for a wonderful presentation, and it's just so important for everyone to be aware of the role of radiation oncology, and this is, I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Heather Wakely, and Dr. Wakely is Assistant Professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Stanford University, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Wakely is going to address new treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, and managing side effects and pain. Dr. Wakely?
Thanks. So it's great to be here and get a chance to talk to everybody about this. So we have seen remarkable advances in the treatment options that we have for patients who have been diagnosed with lung cancer, and I'll be focusing, of course, on advanced stage lung cancer today. Dr. Chris went through this very nicely as well, and I think his point that lung cancer is not one disease but many is, I think, one of the most important takeaway points for everybody listening today. And where that comes into practice is that the importance of having a tissue diagnosis, of having a biopsy, is really critical to help the physicians in discussing with the patient what is going to be the best individual approach for that person living with this disease. And in the past few years, just remarkable advances have been made in helping us to guide treatment on a more individual basis based on what's found on those tissue biopsies. And where this is, I think, most striking is that we are now able not just to have pathologists don't just look under the microscope and say, this looks like non-small cell or small cell, or Dr. Chris had mentioned the subtypes of adenocarcinoma and squamous, but we take it now a step further and are actually able to do testing, looking at the genes that are involved in making up the tumor and seeing how those differ in the different cancers. And based on that information, have specific treatments for some of the gene changes that can happen. And Dr. Chris mentioned the EGFR and the ALK, and I just want to mention those again because that really has changed our practice dramatically, so that when I have a patient who comes to see me, before we make a treatment decision to start off on chemotherapy or not, we try to get the answers from the genes and figure out if a patient has an EGFR gene change or an ALK gene change or something else. Chemotherapy can still work for everybody, and that's still a standard, and I do want to emphasize that, as Dr. Chris did. But for some patients, if we can find a gene change in their tumor, we can pick a treatment that's different than chemotherapy, might be a little bit more tolerated for that reason, oftentimes is a little bit more active. And so that's really where I think we've seen the biggest changes, and those are the new treatment approaches. The other big changes that have happened is an understanding of how much we should be giving chemotherapy for how long. In the past, we would, when patients were diagnosed, give them chemotherapy for usually about 3 months or so, and then give people a chemotherapy holiday. And more recently, we've been learning that chemotherapy holiday really isn't the best plan for most patients. That for most patients, if we can continue on with a tolerated chemotherapy drug, either continuing what was started initially or switching to something else without that chemo holiday, on average, patients tend to feel better longer with their disease under better control. And so that's one of the big changes that's been happening in our treatment approaches as well. And obviously this is an individual issue. It's something that needs to be discussed between each patient and their physician. But this is a concept called maintenance therapy, where we don't give such big breaks from treatment anymore because of the results of multiple clinical trials. I also want to talk about the importance of the combination when we're dealing with chemotherapy. Oftentimes when someone's just diagnosed, combinations of more than one drug is usually more effective than a single drug. And we just had some new information about that at our annual meeting, the ASCO meeting, which just happened last weekend, again showing that even for patients who are having some side effects, well, I should say symptoms related to their cancer, if they're able to handle a combination of chemotherapy, on average they do a lot better. And so just to make sure that that's part of the discussion that people are having with their physicians, talking about, you know, there's a lot of fear of the side effects of chemotherapy, and sometimes the symptoms of the cancer are not recognized as much. And so it's important to weigh those two things, keeping in mind that even though chemotherapy is going to have some side effects, by controlling the cancer better, on average patients are going to feel better. And so oftentimes a little bit more of the chemotherapy can be better. I was also asked to talk about clinical trials, and I think that I'm delighted to talk on that topic because it allows me to emphasize that pretty much everything that we know about how to treat lung cancer and how to help people living with that diagnosis comes from history of patients who have gone on to clinical trials in the past, that we know about these drugs that can target tumors that have the EGFR mutation because patients in the past were willing to go on trials to try them out. We know about all the chemotherapy drugs that we have for that reason. We know that about this maintenance approaches because patients in the past have been brave enough to try something different that was, again, usually based on solid information leading to the trials, but it still takes patients willing to do that and understanding that the way that we help all patients with the disease and all patients in the future with the disease is by participation in these clinical trials. Some of the more exciting results that were coming out at the meeting that we just had, the ASCO meeting, had to do with tumors that had different mutations, not just the EGFR mutation, but something called KRAS, which is a pretty common mutation, and until recently we really haven't had good drugs to target that, but there was some promising information that came out at the meeting from some trial results. We also heard a lot about what do we do when some of these targeted treatments aren't working as well? How do we get beyond this resistance that develops? And again, a lot of promise coming out at ASCO this year with treatments that can work to help people get that response that they initially had to the drugs that might not be working as well, get back to that response and help people continue to live their lives with their cancer under control. And that concept of keeping the cancer under control and helping people really live their lives even though they are dealing with cancer, I think is the most important concept we have when we're as oncologists, helping patients living with their illness. And it's really the chemotherapy and these other treatments, we're obviously hoping to help people keep their disease under control, but we're also trying to help people keep their symptoms under control so they can do the things that matter. And managing side effects is critical. There has been, you know, some of the clinical trial works, as Dr. Chris was talking about earlier, focus on managing symptoms and side effects. It's important to not be afraid to talk about symptoms and side effects of chemotherapy with your oncologist and the treatment team to make sure that if you're having nausea and vomiting, you're letting people know so we can work on better drugs. If you're having pain, you're letting people know so we can work on better treatments. Dr. Wernerosek mentioned radiation can be an important component of treating pain, especially pain from bone disease and other sites, but not to be afraid of the medications either. Narcotics can be incredibly helpful for a large number of patients, and unfortunately there's a lot of stigma around them, so people are often afraid to talk about the pain sometimes because they're afraid that they're going to get narcotics and they might get addicted. And I just want to emphasize to people that if you're taking narcotics for pain, the addiction is not a concern. You really don't need to be worried about it. It's important to take the medications that are needed to control the pain so that you can continue living your life and doing the things that are important to you. There are obviously medications besides narcotics as well, and it's important to work closely with the treatment team on that. And that's where we can bring in not just the oncologists, nurses, social workers, but also supportive oncology, which is usually a multidisciplinary team of care providers who work in addition to the oncology team to help patients in controlling their symptoms, such as pain, nausea, and those sorts of things. So I just want to emphasize the importance of sort of this team approach to therapy, the focus on fighting the cancer, but also fighting the symptoms so that we can get people living their life with the best quality for as long as possible. And that can be quite a long time now for many of our patients, which has been a wonderful change that we've been seeing. So I'll end with that and look forward to answering questions.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Wakely, for just a wonderful presentation and also just for highlighting the importance of really many treatments to enhance quality of life. And so it's very important in the communication with the team. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Donna Wilson. Donna Wilson is a pulmonary clinical nurse specialist, fitness coordinator, Integrative Medicine Center, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Ms. Wilson is going to address physical activity and nutritional concerns and tips. And it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Ms. Wilson.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me today. I'm going to start this out by saying exercise is medicine. I can't tell you for the last 10 years that I've been exercising people with cancer that it doesn't matter the stage of cancer that you're in, but if you start to exercise, you really can improve your physical functioning. And I think it's just trying to understand. You breathe because of the muscles of your chest wall. You breathe because you're using your diaphragm, which is a really large muscle for breathing. And there has been numerous research projects to show that exercise improves fatigue, it decreases depression, it improves sleep, it improves breathlessness. It improves your quality of life, and that's what we really want to achieve here. We really want to improve your quality of life while dealing with this chronic disease. I think that there was a great study that came out in 2009. It's a small study, but it was with people with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, and actually it showed that if they exercised twice a week, and did aerobics and weight training, that over an eight-week period, that they actually improved their lung cancer symptoms and increased their strength. So it makes a difference that if you're stronger, you can then enjoy all these activities of daily living. The American Cancer Society has really said that they would like all patients to exercise 30 minutes at least five times a week, or 150 minutes a week. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to exercise for 30 minutes in one lump sum. You could do 10 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes. Or if you're just starting out to exercise, you start out slowly. Don't, you know, just start about improving your endurance, and then we'll increase the strength training. A lot of the strength training for yourself, you could be done in the chair. You could do a lot of upper body strength training and coordinating your breathing pattern as you do the strength training in a chair or on an exercise ball. The reason you do that is because you don't want to just exercise and not coordinate your pattern of breathing. When you're in a standing position, your spine is holding you up, and sometimes people will fatigue faster by doing the exercises in an upright position. Breathing exercises are key. I think that learning to control your pattern of breathing, to learn to know that the most important aspect of breathing is breathing out, really lengthening that air out so you can get better air in. You want to oxygenate better so that you can really oxygenate all your muscles of your body. I think that strength training is key, but I do believe the breathing is even more important. If you, even by stretching your upper body and stretching your arms over your head as you're doing some breathing exercises, arms over your head, arms out to the side, a very simple exercise to exercise your diaphragm is to keep your mouth closed and breathe quickly in and out of your nose, because that's a direct connection. As you breathe in and out of your nose, it is a direct connection to the diaphragm. So it really does make a difference. If you're starting out, then think about using large muscle groups for exercise. I would start with doing getting up and down out of the chair, not pushing off arms of the chair, but getting up out of the chair, using your buttocks, squeezing your buttocks, and breathing out, getting you up, because it is such a large muscle. also just doing general squats or doing a shoulder press, which involves multiple muscles. So you try to think of all these things to do. If there's a yoga program by you, a yoga, just gentle yoga is an excellent program to do to really learn about your breathing and collaborate your breathing with some very nice long stretching episodes. So the key here really is think about it. You can go walking, you can go swimming, you can go cycling, you can go dancing, you can go gardening, badminton, bowling, stretching. All these things are key. I think if you see stairs, don't be intimidated by the stairs. Remember that when you put your foot on that step, you need to, it's lifting your whole body up. So you breathe out as you go up the steps. If you would like to go for a walk during lunch, if you're having a lunch with a friend, go for a small walk and then get, as a little bit of exercise, may stimulate your appetite even more. And I think that go on trips or with friends. Don't isolate yourself. I think that's one of the negatives that I see that people tend to do. When you're walking, it is hard to do breathing and speaking at the same time. So just to set the standard before you start, to tell someone, well, you know, let's go for a walk and then we can sit down and chat afterwards. Get a pedometer and really evaluate how much you're walking. You'll be very surprised that you will be walking a lot more than you actually do. But the key is if there's, you know, you get tapes, you can go to the library and get tapes. If you like to hum or you like to sing, it's a great way of lengthening your breathing out. So I think those are kinds of things that I would suggest, but do not become sedentary. I really believe that exercise is medicine. From an eating perspective and a nutrition perspective, many lung patients, really, I would have to say that you should eat in small meals. But if you increase, have a large meal and your stomach is full, it commonly will push up on your diaphragm and make you feel short of breath because your stomach is so full. So eat in short, you know, maybe five times a day with smaller meals. Make sure that you eat really healthy. We don't have an anti-cancer diet. We don't have, you know, the best diet for cancer, but we do look at the Mediterranean diet, which is really relatively healthy. It's with olive oils, which is a good oil, taking away a lot of that heavy animal fat. Do fruits and vegetables, which are really healthy, and fish, and really reduce your sugar intake. And think about when you buy your fruits and vegetables, make sure you really wash them really well to remove any pesticides. Some of the fruits and vegetables that are low in pesticides are onions and corn and pineapple, avocado, which is a great, very healthy fat, asparagus, mangoes, cabbage, watermelon. These are all really wonderful things to eat that have a really low pesticide level. But I think that would be my most important. If you have trouble eating, you might find that you will go and find a protein, a whey protein, and mix that and make your own fruit smoothie. Sometimes if you look at Ensure and N Plus, they have a little bit too much sugar in them, so you might want to find there is one now coming out that's low sugar. So you really want to look at how you're feeding your body, but make sure that you do not decrease your protein levels, because when you decrease your protein stores in your body, it'll cause muscle weakness as well. So overall, I would say exercise, even if it's as minimal as 5 minutes and you start to work up your daily level of 30 minutes a day or so, think about doing some slow stair climbing. Think about doing some like weight training, and also think about eating frequently, but eating mindful eating. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Donna, for an excellent presentation. Just very informative and just lots of information. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Mr. Wynn Burkle, and Mr. Burkle is Director of Social Service in Long Island. He's a lung cancer program coordinator of Cancer Care, and he's going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care and support groups for people living with cancer and their caregivers. Wynn?
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm sure most of us remember the time we moved into our first new home or even our last new home, and I'm sure we wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon, or maybe a very helpful neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily life. The more things we were able to connect to in our new neighborhood, the more we felt that we had things under control. Being diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer is, in some ways, very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you. Rather than burden folks with heavy medical jargon, lungcancer.org has been designed as the first stop for people who find themselves in the new and strange neighborhood of lung cancer. In addition, lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available free of charge for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. These services include education, and through Cancer Care's Many Connect education workshops, which provide both disease-specific information, such as today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Cancer Care's well-known Connect booklets are available free of charge and are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. To date, we have distributed over 3 million copies of these very popular publications. Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services, including subscribing to its popular free monthly newsletter. Another important service is support. Cancer Care's professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of metastatic lung cancer, including emotional issues, practical issues, and navigating the system, and social issues dealing with Cancer Care's impact among family members, friends, the community, and the workplace. Cancer Care's social workers provide this assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as individual counseling in both face-to-face, online, and telephone modes, and support groups, face-to-face, online, and telephone. Support groups can be such an important, really important piece of support for those dealing with metastatic lung cancer, in that you're working together with folks who are, like you, diagnosed with lung cancer and are all really working through the process of managing life with lung cancer and realizing that lung cancer isn't all of life, it's just a part of life. And the groups are so wonderful in helping people achieve that sense and that sort of new sense of the environment of lung cancer. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of metastatic lung cancer. But now that you're here, be assured that Cancer Care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE, H-O-P-E. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Wynn. Just a very eloquent presentation and wonderful information about the service of Cancer Care. Now, we do have time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. I want to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If you don't get to ask your question, you can always call us at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Mm-hmm. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Jacqueline W. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. I was wondering what the affinity for a metastasis has to do with the adrenal gland. That would be my first question. And the second question would be that in the news lately there has been a lot of press regarding lung cancer that is associated with people who have never smoked, and oftentimes they're women. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for those questions. And Dr. Chris, would you address those?
Sure. I think Dr. Werner Wasik talked about the places that lung cancer can spread to, and the adrenal gland, as you point out, is one of them. The adrenal gland is a hormone-making gland. It makes cortisone and other hormones, and it sits on top of the kidney, and we have two of them. Why lung cancer spreads to that site is unknown. A couple of quick issues about that. The first is we all have two adrenal glands. So even if one is damaged by lung cancer, the other one is functional and can supply our body's needs for hormones. The second thing is there are very commonly growths in the adrenal gland that we have lifelong, so-called adrenal adenomas. And while on a CAT scan they may look like a deposit of cancer, they are benign, something we've had lifelong and of no consequence. So when you have a spot in the adrenal gland, it's very important for your healthcare team to completely evaluate it and make sure it is indeed a deposit of lung cancer. And this is very important at the time of initial diagnosis, where you don't know if that's a deposit of cancer, metastatic spread, or just one of these innocuous lifelong growths that require no therapy.
Thank you very much. And we have a question from one of our online participants. Is it common to have sensations in the chest where radiation was performed for some time after treatment? Dr. Warnawasa, could you address that?
In general, radiation should not cause separate new sensations arising in the chest. Occasionally, there may be long-term slight scar formation, I guess that's possible, but in general not. So that would be a diagnosis of exclusion. So I would encourage anybody who has such sensations to look into other causes in conjunction with their physician before saying it's due to radiation.
Excellent. And we have another question from one of our online participants. In terms of taking a break from chemo, and the question is from Lynn, on chemo for 12 months, been given a three-month break, and is that okay? So I'm going to ask Dr. Wakely to address it in a general way, because, of course, we don't know all the specifics, but if you could address it in a general way for the audience in terms of this taking a break from chemo.
Sure. So there are many, many reasons why one would take a break from chemotherapy, and often it is just fine. The comments I had made earlier about the maintenance treatment are more that, in general, people can stay on chemotherapy as long as it is still tolerated, and in general, as long as the cancer is not growing. But that still tolerated part is a tricky one. And when someone's been doing well on chemotherapy for a full year, many of the side effects, such as fatigue, difficulty with keeping blood counts up, those can build up. And so in many cases, it is certainly fine to take a break from chemotherapy. I offer that to many of my patients when we're in that situation. And oftentimes, they can go for many months before needing to restart therapy. So as long as a patient is continuing to be watched with scans every 2 to 3 months and, you know, physical examination and with awareness of new symptoms and bringing those to the attention of the care team, it's perfectly safe and a very good approach for a lot of folks. So I didn't mean to imply that maintenance was the only way to go, just that it's something that we think about a lot more than we used to, but chemotherapy holidays can still be a fabulous thing for a lot of patients, and so not to be worried about that. I also wanted to quickly get back to one of the earlier questions about never smokers with lung cancer, and just to mention that we don't have great data because we don't have a close link with smoking history and cancer as far as in the databases that we have in the country. But we do think that about 20% of women who get lung cancer have never smoked, and probably around 10% of men. So this is a real issue. The stigma of smoking and associated with lung cancer is a real issue for all patients with lung cancer, whether they have a history of smoking or don't have a history of smoking. And so it's important to be able to talk about that with your care team and just to have that out there. We do know that for patients who get lung cancer who don't have a smoking history, we are a little bit more commonly finding some of these gene mutations that we had talked about. And so we do emphasize the importance of looking for those gene changes in all patients, but in the patients who have no smoking history, it is a little bit more common. And so just to mention that.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been extraordinary. This has been an amazing team working together. These are exactly the team that you all want to have assembled, sort of all these different disciplines working in your behalf. I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked wonderful questions, both on the phone and online. And again, I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour education workshop, and that when we plan a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I do want to recommend that you take advantage of all the services of Cancer Care. And we are simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE. And do please feel free to call us with any questions you might have or concerns. And also do take advantage of all the different services that we offer that are free. Most importantly, as we conclude, I wouldn't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with lung cancer, with metastatic disease, with metastatic lung cancer. I want you to now know that you're part of a community of support, and we're truly here to help you. Again, thank you all for participating, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.